Well, then I read from the book The Cancer Planet Mission of Ludwig Palman. You know that we have done the introduction of the story by Wendell Stevens. Cancer Planet Mission, the introduction to a series of books about cosmophilosophy, has to be considered a revolutionary literary work. Ever since a young man with a pacifist heart escaped the Gestapo and found refuge in England, the most shattering events have happened in his life. Recently, the leading London newspaper, The Guardian, under the headline "To Peru from Space," reported Mr. Palman, that means the author, was doing food research for the Agriculture University of Lima, Peru, in order to find an inexpensive high protein food. He hit on arrowroot as a binding agent. Whilst doing biological research near the upper Amazon River, and here begins what some reports call the greatest cosmic story ever told. We are faced with the undeniable fact that God has created man not just on one particular planet. There are far superior men and women on other planets, superior not in pride, contempt and hypocrisy, but in health, respect and happiness. Friends of cosmophilosophy believe it to be absurd that God should only be considered with one particular faint and with only one particular planet. There is this spiral galaxy of Andromeda. It is one of a million galaxies and consists of several million suns. Most of these suns have created billions of planets similar to ours. There, the author tells us, with the same endeavor as on our planet, the human animal has murdered God and their fellow human beings, but also many civilizations have reached the higher form of development, and through biological age. On such planets, the usual glory and power seekers, warmongers, the gods of myth, fear and superstition no longer exist. Cosmophilosophy tells about the wisdom of these people and the courage to new faith. How they survived the greatest disasters, how they developed their amazing spacecrafts in order to settle on other planets, how they achieved happiness and a longer span of life, how they finally made peace between themselves and God. Mr. Palman's diary speaks with enthusiasm of the amazing central energy generation of their spacecraft, but most longingly he talks about their cosmophilosophy, which has long replaced the hypocrisies and superstitions of less developed planets. Our ethics are based on love, compassion, reincarnation, threats of hell, and a general theological pattern fixed and stiffened by dogmas thousands of years old. Their pattern, or the future pattern, or religion is based on mutual respect, and because of this code, he was told that most advanced civilizations on other planets are not at all the monsters pictured by science fiction, but they are cheerful and humble people of great intelligence. They believe that God does not punish nor offer specific commandments, but that God is nature, and only through the observation of nature are we able to understand God. If we are punished, we have not been punished by God, but by ourselves, for by disregarding the laws of nature, which, according to our friend from out of space, are the laws of God himself. Their philosophy is determinist too, and they know that in time, when they have gone even further ahead, we shall arrive where they are now, and abolish wars as they have, and with them superstitions and factional religions. Mr. Pullman has managed, in putting pen to paper, to write an enthralling and stimulating book, in which is not only very readable, but has given us the message of a revolutionary, futuristic pattern of life, cosmophilosophy. Then comes chapter 1, which is I Meet Sathura. The cosmic story of Amat Maina begins in London, not that London swinging or prosaic depending upon how old you are and how you look at it, played much of a part in the shattering events that were to befall me. So it so happened that I was in London at the time, going about my lawful occasions in the normal course of my business. My business, loosely speaking, is the sale and installation of heavy machinery used in the large-scale production of food. For example, milling assemblies for the fine grinding of cereals on a waste program. I was visiting London at the time, for my business makes me a perpetual globetrotter. It chanced that I was in London on that first day of October 1964. I was taking a brief pause in a heavy Latin American itinerary, and also making the necessary arrangements for the next part of my schedule, India. As I recall it, the weather that Thursday morning was fine. The sun still had warmth in it, although there was a hint of approaching autumn. The streets, as usual, were parked as I made my way from the Strand Palace Hotel to India House, where I made application for a visitor visa to visit just India. The business was conducted in a very agreeable fashion with a youngish official who wished me well and hoped that I would find a viable proportion to install in the future a battery of machinery for cereal grinding. As he put it, anything that would help to solve India's chronic food problem, any kind of technical improvement would be welcome. After lunch, I set about making the necessary travel arrangements, Here I met my first snag. I could not get an immediately direct flight. As I didn't want to cool my heels too long in London, I settled for an alternative route, which meant that I had something like 36 hours to kill. I passed the time boning up on India, for it was years since I had last visited that huge subcontinent. Now we enter next page, 32 in the book, of Cancer Plan Mission. Well, the page numbering is 32 on Wendell Stevens publishing. It's page 8 on the original book of Mr. Pullman. Top of page 8. As I upset, the flight was without interest. The last leg was from Tehran to Calcutta, and I landed at Dum Dum Airport around about midnight, the 4th of October. Although I had been to India before, I had never been to Dum Dum Airport. It has to be seen to be believed. My first impression of it was that of a madhouse of carnival time. It was a brutal brought slap into the middle of the 20th century and set in the heart of India. I had to force a very through the way through the teeming crowds that thronged the concourse. There were people waiting to emplane, people waiting for incoming flights, and people just waiting. People. People of all ages, people of all shapes and sizes, people of all colors and nationalities. No wonder, I thought, as I made my way to a taxi, that India has a food problem. As I settled in the taxi and told the driver to take me to the Oberon Grand Hotel, I remembered a story that I had heard several years before. It's a story about people meeting. It is alleged that the three Frenchmen got together for lunch, then they would have started a new political party before the time they had reached their coffee. If three Germans meet, they form a protection society, and the first resolution they pass is one calling upon heaven to protect them from the competition of Japanese gadgetry. Similarly, three Spaniards would form a company to manufacture crystal candlers, whilst three Americans would immediately form a luncheon club and set about drafting menus for the next meetings. But if three Indians met, they would at once call in another 30 Indians and organize a religion festival in honor to their gods. I thought of this anecdote as the taxi waved its honking way through the crowded streets. There were obvious signs of the Indians' preoccupation with his gods. I even saw a cow bring traffic to a halt just before the taxi stretched to a stop outside of the Oberon Grand Hotel. The Oberon Grand is something left over from the spacious days of the British Raj. If I were asked to give my impression of the Oberon Grand in a few words, but I would have to say that for me it stands as a citadel for modern cult of servility. The Oberon Grand is raised by any standards. It never seems to have many guests in it at any time, or rather there is always room to move. But however many guests there are, they are always outnumbered by the servants. I don't know the exact ratio of servants to guests, but at an estimate I should say that there are anything from 5 to 8 servants to each guest in the hotel. Now, for the man who lives out of a suitcase, this surfeit of servants poses an immediate problem. Tipping. I think I am a bit of an expert on tipping, as I've tipped my way around the world on many occasions. Some say that the world originates in France and comes from Corpoir. This means showing satisfaction for services rendered by giving the servant some money in order to buy a drink. Others say that the world derives from the initial letters of 3 other words to ensure promptness. This means that you buy quick service by greasing the servant's palm with money. Whatever the origin of the word, a traveler staying in a hotel is still expected a tip, despite the 10% that is often added to the bill as a service charge. I've tipped in many strange places, but I never tipped as I was expected to tip in India. Here you are ranked according to the way you tip. A smallish tip and you are a Maharaja, or at least a Mahatma. A bigger tip and you are a Mandarin, a veritable saint. Of course, if you don't give any tip at all, then you are dirty, mean, loose, and you have to get your drinking water for yourself. In India, you hear the word bakshish 100 times a day. Bakshish. You have to use your own judgment whether or not you do give a tip. The starving, wide-eyed, unsmiling children of India make you think twice before you give anybody a tip. And they make you wonder why you tip at all. Certainly, in this country, you never give a fat man a tip. I quickly found this out. As I just quickly found out about the real value of money and of life. You have to learn the art of giving the right amount of money to the right people at the right time. Otherwise, you would be everlastingly tipping. This was my philosophy, a materialistic philosophy, I must admit, as I went about my business in Calcutta. But I found, as I went from contact to contact, that this appeared to be the normal Indian way of life. Next page. As I moved about the business quarter of Calcutta, so I was impressed by the sheer number of people I saw. I knew that India, like China, was undergoing a population explosion, but I was not prepared for the milling crowds that thronged the streets at all hours of the day and night. There weren't happy crowds. Indeed, they did not look well-fed crowds. In a common knowledge that a vastly increasing world population is making rapid inroads into the dwindling food resource available to Earth, some people, some governments are doing all they can to grapple with the problem. Here in India, everybody from high government officials to the lowest of workers seem overwhelmed by inertia, so that they are unable to do anything positive to ameliorate the acute conditions of want that prevail. Never in all my life I have seen a place like India that is screaming out for swift, efficient organization in order that people might survive, let alone enjoy a decent standard of living. And as I went from one businessman to another in a few days that I spent in Calcutta, I thought I saw the main reason why there was this inertia, this attitude of fanatism. It is linked with bureaucratic red tape, but above all with religion. No, I'm not one to knock our organization and administration or it serves some useful function. Although I'm not what you might call an orthodox religious person, yet I hope I respect that religious belief of others. I suppose you might call this the live and let live part of my basic philosophy. But out here in India, I saw a country that was being strangled by its own bureaucratic red tape, a country that was dying because of its religious fatalism. I had to scroll down. I'm not exaggerating when I make these admittedly sweeping charges. I'm all my wanderings over the face of the globe, in all my dealings with businessmen and with government officials. I have never met such finically instance of protocol, such cultivated bureaucracy for the sake of bureaucracy, such skepticism and superstition as I have encountered in India. I not only met intransigent officials and also immovable businessmen. I come up against half-gods, saints, spirits, and inevitably the holy animals by the thousands. It staggered me that it was so sin in India to let a child die of starvation, that it was a mortal sin to kill a sacred animal, even if that sacred animal was the very lowly rat, as it very often was. That was next page. Page 11 in the book, the original book. My good intentions towards the Indians and their food problem was very dwindled to a resigned, albeit sentimental, detachment. Perhaps detachment is the better word, for although I could not make any progress with my business plans, did I become very much attached to India, and also despite their inertia, fatalism to many of the Indians with whom I came into contact. But it was the attachment to the tourist and to the sightseer, not of the technician wanting to sell machinery, not the attachment of an involved human being wanting to do something for starving people. After a few days of this, hitting my head against the brick wall of Indian bureaucracy and religious fatalism, I decided that Calcutta was no place for me. After all, I had come all this way to India with a business proposition. I had not come as an idle spectator to the Indian scene, a rubber-necking tourist. So I checked out the Auburn Grand Hotel, having paid the tipping ransom first, and crossed the subcontinent to Bombay. At least Bombay was western-looking, geographically, if no other way. Bombay was just as bad as Calcutta. I soon discovered that there were import and export rules by the hundred. Most Western countries have this type of regulation, but here in Bombay, the government had run riot with hundreds of them, each succeeding one more rose than the previous one. If I could have entered into a business arrangement, then I found out that I would spend all of my time making out endless lists, filling in countless forms, praying of duty and tax that would have beggared a philanthropic society, and I represented a business concern. After I had spent a couple of days in Bombay and had had time to size up the situation, I realized that I was getting nowhere fast. All these restrictions were understandable in the light of India's recently won independence. She was still suffering from the mistrust of the alien, the suspicion of the undesirable foreigner. I gave up the unequal struggle, reflecting it was pointless trying to do business in these circumstances. Every penny invested would have been at risk. The threat of nationalism was such that a businessman was always on the lookout for a means of escape, even though that escape might involve a last despairing jump from a high window. Now we have reached half an hour, as these parts intend to be. I stop this section here, continues on next part.